Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Green History. On Wednesday, August 27th at 6 p.m., Susan Ferentinos, public history researcher, consultant, and writer, presented a program called Historic Preservation as a Green Alternative. The presentation centers on historic preservation and how it protects community. It is also often a far greener option than new construction. In this talk, Ferentinos explores the recent efforts between the Historic Preservation Society and green building movements to create a sustainable future together by combining energy conservation with the reuse of existing building stock. This talk was hosted by Green Drinks Bloomington and recorded by Molly O'Donnell for Standing Room Only on WFHB.
Well, hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on what I know is a very busy week in Bloomington. Excited to be here tonight, getting to talk. I've been to a number of Green Drinks events, but I'm excited to get to talk about a personal area that I get to work in and its intersections with building a green future. And so I'll be talking tonight on historic preservation as a green alternative. And I think that any gathering, any group of people who are committed to talking about green alternatives and a green future, the built environment needs to be a significant part of that conversation. The U.S. Energy Information Administration has stated that buildings are actually the biggest consumers of energy in this country. And so if we're looking to talk really substantially about energy reduction, building stock, buildings, and the way that communities interact with buildings should be a big part of that discussion. And my personal plan here today is to argue that in addition to the push to employ green building methods in new construction, historic buildings and efforts to save, restore, and retrofit older historic buildings need to be a very substantial part of this conversation. So with that in mind, I'll just throw out there that the whole mantra of the movement to reduce, reuse, and recycle is kind of writ large when we're talking about building stock. And that's what makes this area, at least personally, very exciting to me. And so my plan for the few minutes I have to talk to you tonight is to look, those first two items on my PowerPoint, is to talk about two realms in which historic preservation is particularly relevant to the conversation about green building. And that is the inherent greenness of older buildings and also the energy costs of restoring existing buildings versus new construction. Then I must admit that there are some challenges with this approach that need to be addressed as we move forward. And then I just want to wrap up with something that I think might make for a rich discussion during the question and answer period of the role of history and historic preservation specifically within the larger idea and concept of sustainability. So to start with, there is a, I would argue, an inherent greenness, an inherent way that older buildings, generally speaking, mesh and fit in with the concept of creating a green future. There's a very common saying in the little world that where historic preservation and green building overlap, that the greenest building is the one that is already built. And this this is true for a couple of reasons. One is that, again, generally speaking, there are so many different buildings that have been built in the United States over time, different types of buildings, different eras and styles of building. But generally speaking, and particularly with pre-World War II buildings, they tend to be built of much more durable materials than modern buildings are. They were built to last, particularly civic buildings, were built with an ethic that these were representations of the community that would last for generations and generations. And having been built to last, preservationists that are conversant with green issues tend to argue that we should let them last. An example of the contrast between older building techniques with these more durable materials and modern building techniques is the example of windows. Pre-World War II, windows were built to last indefinitely with proper maintenance and repair. And so even now, they can be repaired as part of an older house. Whereas modern windows, generally speaking, are made to become obsolete, to wear out and then be replaced, not to be repaired. So that is one small example of all manner of, you know, we're all very familiar with just the way things are constructed, not just buildings, but consumer items are constructed in this era to wear out and not be compared. And that's a very different ethic and guiding principle than in previous earlier generations. In addition, buildings that were built, generally speaking, before the mid 20th century were built during an era that was far less dependent on fossil fuels than our modern era. And so they lend themselves, a lot of the techniques of green building that are in play now are inspired by or conversant with older methods that simply didn't have that kind of availability. For one thing, historic neighborhoods tend to be much more compact, and walkability is a central component of those neighborhoods because cars weren't in wide use by average American families up until the mid-20th century. In addition, the features of the building, the historic buildings themselves, and often their surrounding landscape, were created to work with the environment in large part because, for instance, air conditioning didn't exist, and access to water was not as reliable in many parts of the country as it is now. And so, for instance, rainwater capture is a common feature of historic buildings. Likewise, a lot of historic building features make use of the surrounding environment instead of simply depending on modern conveniences. For instance, cross-ventilation is much better in historic buildings than in modern construction that assumes air conditioning will be in use. Large windows, particularly in older warehouses and factories, were designed and combined with high ceilings to make natural sunlight a major part of where the light was coming from. There's all kinds of, you know, it can go on and on about the different ways that features of historic buildings contribute and compensate for lower energy use. In addition to my argument that historic buildings just carry an inherent greenness that to some extent is being recreated in the green building movement, improved on possibly, but also possibly to some extent reinventing the wheel that already exists from previous eras. There's also the argument of just the energy involved in tearing things down and putting up new things. No matter how energy efficient that new thing is, there's a certain amount of waste that is involved in throwing something out that already exists and bringing something new in. And this whole pattern within U.S. culture of tearing buildings down and rebuilding buildings, this is not even getting into new construction in formerly undeveloped natural areas, but simply tear down and reconstruction, is at really extreme and disturbing proportions. You see that picture there on my PowerPoint slide. The Brookings Institute estimates that nearly a quarter of existing building stock will be demolished between 2005 and 2030. And that is 82 billion square feet of existing buildings will be torn down.
You're listening to Green History on Standing Room Only. Susan Ferrantinas has been explaining the tension between historic preservation and green construction. Next, the speaker relates some experiences from her field on Standing Room Only.
And so while that's disturbing, I'm a historian by training, and while that's disturbing on so many different levels for a historian, for people that are concerned about the green future, that has some very significant environmental consequences. So one concept that is in play among the people within the preservation movement that are having this conversation is a concept of embodied energy. And forgive me, I'm not sure how widespread that concept is, so let me explain to you what I mean by that term. But the idea is basically that resources and energy have been invested in the creation of any building, and that energy cannot be, it has been expended. It cannot be gotten back. And when a building is demolished, that energy is wasted, whereas a renovation, a retrofitting, is investing in an energy investment that was already made. In addition, when you tear down a building, historic or otherwise, that tear down material, I understand part of the green building movement is to recycle as much building material as possible, but that is one small part of new building construction. And that debris from demolished buildings quite likely ends up in the landfill. And that is on a scale that's pretty extreme. It's estimated that 25% of the country's landfill is currently devoted to construction and demolition. So in addition to conserving buildings and adapting existing buildings rather than new construction is a way to potentially greatly reduce landfill use as well. And the energy that it takes to build a new building, to demolish a building and then build a new building, is actually very significant, and it's difficult to recoup. It takes a long time to recoup that energy outlay in energy savings of a new building. It's been estimated that even with sustainable construction techniques, new buildings take an average of 30 years of energy savings costs to recoup the energy that was expended in the course of constructing that new sustainably constructed building. And a 2011 report by the Preservation Green Lab looked specifically at buildings that were 30% more energy efficient than the buildings they were replacing. And looking specifically at that, depending on the type of building, and actually also the region of the country, it took between 10 and 80 years to recoup the energy, to reduce the cost of energy cost of building the building in energy savings. So again, just to recoup, I would say that historic buildings tend to be inherently have green features that can be built upon and worked with, and that also the appeal of using something existing versus destroying it and creating something new are two aspects of historic preservation that dovetail beautifully with the values of green building. But there are some challenges, and most of them revolve around the fact that the green building movement and the historic preservation movement haven't been at the same table from the get-go. So there's definitely conversation happening, and it's a really exciting conversation. You know, my world is the historic preservation movement, and within that profession, within that field, there's a really interesting conversation going on. But it's not system-wide, and likewise, it's not in the green building movement. So there's a need for a dialogue and, to some extent, a melding of the values of these two ways of looking at the built environment. So in terms of the green building movement, there's not necessarily a lot of understanding of the specific situation of the specific circumstances of historic buildings, and there has not been the energy standards and certification requirements, for instance, are aimed at new building construction. It's possible, for instance, to get LEED certification on a historic building, but it's not the most straightforward thing to do. There's a lot of little workarounds that have to happen. And in addition, for instance, this concept of embodied energy from the preservationist point of view is a very important one, and kind of when you just explain it, it seems pretty straightforward and it makes sense. But you know, within the world of environmentalism, it's difficult to quantify that embodied energy. And so there's currently no uniform standard way to measure embodied energy, and that becomes problematic when you're talking about, you know, in a really concrete scientific way about energy savings. Likewise, within the historic preservation movement, lots of really exciting things are going on within the preservation movement in the last generation. But the foundation of historic preservation and historic preservation law in this country is from a different era, in which historic preservation was very much aimed at preserving great works of art in the form of architecture and the homes of great Americans. And so the organizing principles of the field still are coming out of that era of preservation, even though preservation is much more dynamic and involved in economic vitality and remembering the full range of American experience. The guiding principles and the laws still tend to refer to a different standard that make it tricky. For instance, the idea of integrity, keeping the building very much as it was in the past, is a big part of historic preservation. And in many cases, that's an essential principle if you're preserving a historically significant building. It's less of an important principle when you're talking about saving a historic building because it retains the character of a small community and saves the energy costs of tearing it down and building something new. Potentially, historic preservation regulations could be a little more flexible, for instance, in retrofitting that building to be more energy efficient. Just a few other issues that need to be, some of the kinks that need to be worked out as we move forward with this conversation. One is the rehabilitation of a historic building tends to be just, you know, it's a little less predictable than building a new building from scratch. And so many developers or funding entities tend to shy away from rehabilitation of older buildings as opposed to building new. And that, you know, I mean, that financial incentive of having a smooth clear-cut job comes into play. And then another issue that's in play now and coming down the pike is all these trends I was discussing of historic buildings. Again, there are exceptions before World War II, there's exceptions after World War II, but after World War II, in the middle of the 20th century, new architectural styles and a new dependence on fossil fuels made building techniques quite different than other historic buildings. And within the historic preservation field, as far as designations and regulations, that really kicks in at about the 50-year mark. And so in preservation terms, these buildings for the last 15 years or so have been coming into the realm of preservation. And they have a different set of issues because in many cases, those buildings are quite less energy efficient than modern buildings and modern standards. And how to preserve that part of the nation's history in the built environment, on the landscape, and honor those architectural styles at the same time not wrecking the nation's future by preserving all these incredibly energy inefficient buildings is something that needs to be worked out. And it's in process, and it's a conversation going on among specialists amidst 20th century architecture. But it is something that will be even more in the conversation as we move forward.
We will return in a moment to green history. Susan Ferrantinas has been explaining the tension between historic preservation and green construction. We return now as the Q&A section begins, here on Standing Room Only.
And so I'd like to end with just a general argument that, or a spark for dialogue during the question and answer period, that heritage in general, an understanding of the past, and specifically, since that's what I'm talking about tonight, historic preservation, all fit in very comfortably with within the concept of sustainability. And just as a larger personal mission of mine, I really look forward to that being a more assumed part of sustainability, that sustainability is talking about the future, but that the understanding of the past and a preservation of the nation's heritage is a significant part of that. And I argue that because historic buildings are part of what contributes to sense of place, which is an important concept when we're talking about sustainability. We don't want the unique character of different regions that have different ecosystems and different architectural styles and simply different histories of development to be eroded within this very large country because of modern practices that erase that individual sense of place. Sense of place is part of a sustainable, richer future. And and the specific distinctive styles of older buildings and the heritage and the history that fostered those, the creation of those buildings, I would say is an important part of that. Likewise, stewardship is an important element of sustainability. And generally, from what I can tell in a lot of sustainability conversations, the assumption is that we're talking about stewardship of natural resources, which is incredibly important, but stewardship of cultural resources, including buildings and built environment and historic artifacts, is also part of a general ethic of stewardship. And sustainability requires taking care of all of these resources that are under our purview. And finally, all of these kind of revolve around the general theme of stewardship. But and I'm not the only person that says this, but I think a respect and an understanding of the generations that have gone before us is an important component to creating an ethic of considering future generations in the decisions that we're making in the modern era. As a colleague of mine, Benjamin Filene, has said, the fact that someone came before implies that someone will come after. It implies a sense of stewardship, which might give pause before tearing down the old downtown library to build condos. And so, again, I see there's a lot of potential collaboration and certainly very interesting dialogue to be happening within the world of sustainability and the subset of people that are working in cultural resource protection. So, thank you very much, and I'm really looking forward to conversation and question and answer.
Well, let's take some questions. I know I have a couple. Any questions?
And may I just mention that I also just put up some websites if you want to look into this further.
Can you talk a little bit more about mid-century modern and how that is not energy efficient? You know, so many ways to
explain. Sure. So the question was how. Could I offer a little more detail about how mid-century modern architecture doesn't always work with these general inherent greenness trends that I was talking about with earlier architecture? A lot of times, just generally speaking, the buildings in the post-war period on until the energy crisis of the 1970s were energy was being used quite freely in this country, and so there was an assumption that everything would be well cooled and well heated, and that building features didn't need to address those issues just naturally, that there would always be the energy to heat and cool these buildings. Some famous works of architecture in mid-century modern are certainly not, they're very interactive with their surrounding landscape, and in that sense they present an ethic that's similar to a green ethic now, but involved in that is, for instance, a lack of insulation in the building, all those glass walls and windows, not well insulated. And even without the famous works of architect, the glass-wrapped buildings is an example of a style, an element of mid-century modern style. And that is causing some problems now as those buildings need to be renovated. The question is, can we make energy efficient adaptions so these things aren't just, you know, so heat isn't just rolling out of all these windows in Chicago in the winter? And then that is the question where these ideas of integrity, how do we preserve the building as the architect intended it to be, can clash with that. And so, you know, that's where it gets a little tricky and can be solved with some conversation and innovation, but that needs to happen.
My require here to see your message at the store on a regular basis, but how do we get that message out to developers who are more interested in taking down smaller, older buildings so they can create more square footage to rent out?
Well, I'm glad to hear I'm preaching to the choir, because I wasn't 100% sure if I was going to be, but I would say that a lot of the issues of getting out and advocating for the preservation of historic landscape, and I'm not talking highfalutin historic landscape, I'm talking about, like, you know, small town downtowns, you know, the commercial districts around the town square, on up to historic landscapes. But the task of sort of spreading the word of that as an important element of what we as a nation, our community does, I think is along the same lines as people in the green building movement needing to get out and say, okay, so we're building this new building. Are you thinking about what its future energy use is? Are you using recycled materials in its construction material? And so, again, I think there's a power in a dialogue between these two movements. Not like it's not happening at all, but it could be expanded so that there's a general understanding of how these elements fit in to the future that we're trying to create. And economics, you said, I think you mentioned economics, and that's a huge factor, and that has been a huge factor, I'm not sure about within the green building movement, but within the historic preservation movement. Forever, right? We have to prove that it's economically tenable to preserve these buildings. There's not as widespread sympathy of just because it's beautiful and something happened here. There's some, but not a lot. So the big advocacy organization for historic preservation, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, has a whole leg of what their mission is and what the work is that they do in proving the economic importance of retaining sense of place, small town character, and how historic renovation can fit into keeping small, particularly small communities, economically viable. And so I think joining in with the environmentally sustainable as well could only help spread the word.
Mike, can you speak a little bit to the challenges of wind energy generation?
Well, I should say that I am a historic preservationist at kind of a cultural level as opposed to at the, like, hammer level. So I can't speak extensively about it, but the that is very much a part, those adding modern green features kind of behind the scenes tends to be the way that many historic buildings become more energy efficient. The problem is in wrecking with floor plans, but particularly with the exterior of buildings. And so, but things that can happen more, less visibly, but within more the infrastructure of the building.
You're listening to Green History on Standing Room Only. Susan Ferrantinas has been explaining the tension between historic preservation and green construction. Next, the presentation comes to a close on Standing Room Only.
Energy generation basically can't happen visibly.
Right, and okay, so a lot of this is another place where the historic preservation movement, it could stand to have a conversation so that they can relax some of their standards on it. There is, there's some stuff going on roofs that, you know, there's a way to not completely hide solar panels, for instance, but to make them less visible from, you know, from the main view of it. There was a, in Philadelphia, there's a low income, an effort to address a low income neighborhood of historic row houses. And they changed the roofs from black roofs to reflective roofs. And that simple thing really helped the energy efficiency of that building. But that is one of the challenges, is having that.
So we're going to take one more quick question, and we'll do it. You take your hand up there.
Preservation Green Lab is an arm of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which the trust is based in D.C. Green Lab is based in Seattle, and that's because a lot of innovative stuff's going on in the Northwest. Locally, I don't know the details, but we have some people here that probably do. City Hall is a renovated building that is also LEED certified.
Yeah, check out City Hall. How about it, right, Nancy Easton? Right? Come on, you know. Do with it. Nancy's over at the Spencer Time, taking care of a lot of the issues that you really so eloquently discussed. I couldn't agree with you more. I built a new house on a site where a house once stood, so I didn't tear a house down. But I have to say that I really, all of your points of durability and historic preservation, all of those points are really well taken. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
We've got announcements. I've got to go grab the list of announcements, and Marcia will tell you what the rules are for that.
All right. in the course, not that long. So, yeah, announcements, I don't know how many there are. There's, I think, just a handful.
Just four.
Okay, and I want to add one to it, so that makes five.
Oh, five.
So you have 30 seconds.
All right, 30 seconds.
Just tell people the bare bones, what they need to know to get interested in what it is you have going on.
Okay.
Green Greens is really the garage band of sustainable activities in Bloomington, and we intend to keep it that way. So thanks for coming out. We've got some announcements here, and we're going to start with Dave Parsons. Dave is with the Earth Charter Indiana petition.
Oh, okay.
So take it away, Dave.
I wanted to make an announcement. There's a group called Earth Charter Indiana out of Indianapolis. A gentleman named Jim Poizer, their executive director. Some of you may know Jim. They have approached the Environmental Rules Board of the Indiana State Government with a petition to create a climate action plan in the state of Indiana. They did their research, found the Environmental Rules Board was a place to go with this petition. They had a citizens petition that they presented in June, and now they're looking for organizations who will sign on and support this request for a climate action plan in the state of Indiana. So you know an organization, EarthCharterIndiana.org.
Yeah, okay.
EarthCharterIndiana.org. Okay, oh, yeah.
Just be careful of the microphone line here. We've extended as far as we can. Bring up our good friend Rod Spa from Herald Times.
Right. I'm Rod Spa. I'm the news editor at the Herald Times now, former down-to-earth reporter. And I'm here to introduce our news reporter, Lauren. And she's going to be handling a lot of our down-to-earth assignments for the near future, so please say hello before she leaves and give her any ideas or suggestions you might have. Thank you.
Sladen, S-L-A-B-I-N, at
Oh, fantastic. That's a great spot. Next is my dear friend Molly O'Donnell. Take it away, Molly.
All right. I want to let people know that there is a bus going to New York City the day of the UN Climate Summit. But for those who can't go to New York City, and especially the Interfaith Work Youth Group, we're going to have a gathering at the courthouse at 1 o'clock that afternoon, Sunday, September 21st. We'll have several clergy speak, and the youth will speak, and maybe we'll have some music. So if you'd like to know more about it, please contact me.
Okay, we've just got a couple more. We've got our really great friend, Larry Barker from the district. Come on, Larry. Lay down the law.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a busy summer for us. I've been up at the State House, just came back from IEM, working with them on some legislative that deals with our 50% recycling goal that's out in the state. And as you know, we at the district are constantly enhancing programs to benefit you. Coming out next week will be the smartphone app that allows you to come right online on the smartphone, look at all 5 of our recycling locations, determine what you can and what you cannot recycle, what you can do with bulky items, electronics, household hazardous waste, all of that good stuff. Shop us at the district.
Yeah, baby. I get so excited over garbage, you know. But there is no such thing. One man's garbage is another. It's all a loop. It's all just energy. Thank you. Last but not least, we have our dear comrade, Marcia Feldman. I don't know what you're going to say, but...
I don't either. Announcement. There is a bus leaving from Bloomington, I'm not sure exactly where, going to New York City on September 20th. We'll leave the evening of the 20th, I believe, be there for the world's largest climate action ever. That's going to change everything, and you'll want to be there. So it's only $25 to get a bus. We'll ride through the
night. You'll
be at work on Monday morning.
Come join us.
Oh,
I didn't say where.
There's a little addendum there, but shall we say goodbye to everybody, or in other words, to sign on?
Yes. Next month, we'll have Jackie Bauer and Jerry Alperowitz, and they'll be talking about that Georgetown University Energy Prize, which we just found out Bloomington is a quarter finalist for this competition, and it's a really good thing. So please do come back next month. Please tip Kelly well and hang out and continue the conversation.
You've been listening to Green History on Standing Room Only. On Wednesday, August 27th at 6 p.m., Susan Ferrantinos, public history researcher, consultant, and writer, presented a program called Historic Preservation as a Green Alternative. The presentation centers on historic preservation and how it protects community. It is also often a far greener option than new construction. In this talk, Ferrantinos explores the recent efforts between the Historic Preservation Society and green building movements to create a sustainable future together by combining energy conservation with the reuse of existing building stock. This talk was hosted by Green Drinks Bloomington and recorded by Molly O'Donnell for Standing Room Only on WFHB. Edited by David McGrail.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB. Executive producer is Allison Bechtesh.